Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Everyone, and welcome to Feed Your Head. Our first guest tonight is Jerry Ash, and in our second hour, we'll have Alexander Lipan from Amsterdam. Hello, Jerry. Hello. Jerry? Okay. I've answered someone on the phone, and he isn't saying anything, and I do not have Jerry's number. So, Jerry, if this is you, say hello. We're just going to listen to a little bit of music here. We've had a little bit of communication problems. Mercury's retrograde, so nothing to be surprised about. Hello, Jerry.
Hi, again.
It's like, okay, here you are. Yeah, sometimes we have to call back to do all kinds of things, and then we're mixing Skype and phones and blog talk, so it's all a miracle to me because I'm not a techie person. So it's good to have you here. And I
want
to say, you can be found on Facebook at We Are the Market Force. And, you know, that sounds,
one place, yes.
Well, that sounds very powerful, you know, because I think that's one of the things now that so many people feel disempowered, though. You know, they think, well, I'm just one person. I know things are messed up, but what can I do? So then they make a choice. They make the choice to sit in front of the TV and dumb down, which is what the government, corporations, they all want that. But, you know, we have a choice. So would you explain how you got interested in this and decided to get a group going?
Sure. Last year I wrote a book. It's a historical novel based on the life of Mother Jones. And actually I met Mother Jones in 1976, during the bicentennial of the country. I say met her in that I was the co-author of a book called West Virginia, USA, and the other co-author got the assignment of the chapter that was called Fussin' and Feudin'. And in that that chapter was a story about Mother Jones. I didn't write it; he did. But it struck me very strongly, and From that point on, I picked up just about everything I could lay my hands on, books that are, you know, stacked a foot and a half high. every article that I could read, tens of thousands of pages. And over the years, I was just very interested in her story. What I learned was that she wasn't just fighting for pocket change. In the book on West Virginia, it was about her fighting in the coal wars in West Virginia back in 1911, 1912, 1913. But her story went on for 65 years, and the thing that really struck me about this story that was 100 to 150 years ago was that she was not just fighting for pocket change, and she very clearly made it known that she was fighting against economic injustice, against the coal, the not just the coal barons, but the exploiters of the workforce back during the worst of the Industrial Revolution.
Right. Well, like the robber barons, things like that. Like the robber barons and things like that that we've heard about.
Exactly. John D. Rockefeller in particular.
Yes.
Which is also still today a familiar name in West Virginia.
Yeah.
Well, what I really was shocked about was that as I read about these things that were going on 100 to 150 years ago were that they were very, they seemed very familiar to me in terms of what's happening in this country today.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the book and almost immediately began writing the second book, which is the one that you've referred to that I'm writing now, which started out to be create a new Mother Jones. The character in the new Mother Jones book is Molly.
Right. Well, that's close. And Molly uses Mother Jones sort of as an inspiration, doesn't she?
Yes. You know, we've always talked, especially those in the labor movement, have talked a lot about the spirit of Mother Jones.
Right.
In this book, the spirit of Mother Jones comes back as the spirit helper of Molly Jones. Even though Mother Jones has been involved, she died in 1930. The spirit of Mother Jones has been around ever since, but no one's ever seen or heard her. In this book, Molly is able to see Mother Jones, talk to Mother Jones, and she becomes her right hand in fighting the economic injustice of today.
So I like the idea of the story, and I like how you're making somebody who was a living person quite a while ago, like you said, she died in 1930, and just carried on with what she was doing, but you've put it in today's messed up world. So, well, you know, it's like, what have you had so far as like responses to this book?
Well, you know, I started this group called We Are the Market Force, and not just to collaborate on the writing of the book, but certainly it has been a strong thread over the 2 or 3 months that We Are the Market Force has been in existence. And the feedback has been tremendous, because what I'm doing with the book is trying not only just to tell a story of a person who is an example of a person living in poverty, but trying to tell a story about how we can take action on the economic front to fight the battle. She's living in a town called Welch, West Virginia, It's a real town. And
okay.
It's a town that has been, I'm sorry?
No,
It's a town that has been exploited for over 200 years. It was a town that the real Mother Jones was in during the Cold Wars of West Virginia back in the 1900s. Molly is there today. And what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do, is to create a story in which a new Mother Jones, Molly, suffers so terribly from economic injustice and rises up and begins to try to turn the economy of West Virginia around. That concept is what we've been talking about. That's not the only thing we do, and we're the market force. But in a thread, we've talked a great deal about how an individual who is in the worst economic condition you could be, how could a person like that start a movement that would actually turn the economy of the town around and become a model for the country in terms of fighting against the rich?
Right, and what is, I don't know, fanciful, whatever, it's lovely, that she, in your book, forms a Facebook group.
Yeah.
Called We Are the Market Force.
Yeah, We Are the Market Force. Actually, in the strategy actions of Mother Jones, I'm sorry, of Molly Jones in the book, in the developing book, she decides that one of the things she will do is to fight the fight online. And she eventually creates a group called We Are the Market Force in Wells, West Virginia. This is fiction. But I began to think, my, this is such a great idea. Why do we need to wait in fiction for a group to form to fight on the economic front? We've got plenty of groups working and plenty of people out there on the streets working against on the political front. The real issue is on the economic front. And why can't we begin now? Not wait for a book, a work of fiction to come out sometime in the beginning of next year.
Right. So, and like you said, you've got really good response with the idea and with the group. An aside question, have you been to West Virginia? I know you live in Florida now.
Yes, I live in Florida. Of course, I'm a native of West Virginia. I, in fact, went back to Welch. I've been to Welch a couple of times in my lifetime. I lived in northern West Virginia. Welch is in the southernmost point in West Virginia. We're very close to it. And I've just been there briefly a couple of times in my life. So
right.
if I decided that if I'm going to write a book and the primary and most of it is going to take place in Welch, West Virginia, I better go back there.
Okay.
And so I took a week and I went back to West Virginia and spent time in Welch, just getting a feel for what it's like there today, and meeting some of the people who are now becoming characters in the book as I write it. One of the ideas that I got on that visit was, my gosh, I can't dream up characters that are any better than the ones that I visited while I was there. So I've asked some of the townspeople if they will allow me to use their name, and so they would become a namesake in the story, and they've agreed to do that.
That's great. I've only known of one other author who did that, and I can't think of her name right now. But
I hope you'll remember it, because I'd like to know.
I will try. I had just read a book recently, but it was a just a fiction. When I try to get away from everything, I just read murder books. So I can't think, but I thought that was such a nice idea. And
hey, well, like, if you can remember after this show, if you can remember who that is, I'd love to know.
I'll try to find that for you, Jerry. But I think that's great.
I sort of thought it might be unique. I'm enjoying the idea immensely. It is, and one of the reasons why this is so important to me is that I want this book to be more than just fiction, just as Mother Jones' first book was more than just my first book on Mother Jones was a fiction based on fact. And I want this book to be fiction based on fact, and what better way to do that than to use real live characters. And
well,
I am excited about this concept, and I tell you when I got really excited was when I contacted Robert Reich through his secretary and got his permission to use his name as a character in this book.
Okay. Well, now you're using his first name as a character. Are you taking attributes of him and using those too?
Absolutely.
Just the name.
You know,
okay.
The time will come, you know, when this young girl in her early 20s does something amazing in this little town of West Virginia toward, you know, fighting economic injustice, it so interests this character, Robert Reich, that he comes to town, not only to learn more about what she's done, but to become her advisor as the movement begins to look beyond Welch to eventually to the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is such a twist because so many books at the beginning, you see they have the disclaimer that, you know, these characters are not based on any one person and blah, blah, blah. And so you've just turned it around with people's permission, which was a good thing. Hope you got that in writing. I think that is so good. And the fact that you actually did know Virginia and then went back to refresh, that's good because you know from where you're coming.
Yeah.
And so let me ask you, you were talking about the coal barons, and of course West Virginia has seen, well, so much of that, and I don't know now, but in days gone by, lots of coal mining accidents in this country. And, I mean, I've read about that and read about the women, the families, you know, waiting and on and on. So West Virginia has always seen that kind of sadness, and it is a very poor state, as I understand, still. Am I right?
It is, because it was for so long an economy based on coal. And, you know, over the years, coal has been very, very good. Certainly back in during the coal wars of West Virginia, it was very, very bad because people were so, they were economic slaves during that period of time. In the 60s and 70s, coal became very big, and Welch, West Virginia with it became very prosperous. And then, you know, when we began to collapse as an industrial country, particularly in the steel making of Pittsburgh, the coal companies just pulled out. And,
yeah.
These people had, you know, experienced some good times, but, you know, they certainly did not become wealthy like the coal barons did. And so when the coal barons left, they became one of the, Welch is one of the poorest communities in the country.
Well, what are they doing now, Jerry, for income?
Well, first of all, you know, during the peak of coal in the 60s and the 70s, the county of well, the name has slipped me. I'm sorry. Anyway, the county had reached a population of 100,000 people, and that was the third largest county in the state. This was back in the 60s and 70s. Today, that population is down to 22,000. So, obviously, and in the Welsh, which is the county seat, had 7,000 people back in those days. Now it's down to, a little over 2,000. And 40% of them are on some sort of public assistance.
Okay.
All of the downtown commercial buildings are boarded up. It is, there's nothing to do there on a Saturday night. There is a movie theater. It's the only form of entertainment in that very isolated community.
Right. A movie theater and a couple bars, right? It seems
one of the statistics that really struck me about Welsh, 25% of the households in Welsh don't have access to an automobile.
I'm sorry, 25% of the households in Welsh don't have what?
Don't have an automobile.
Okay. Wow.
I can't think of a better way to put it. People are no longer, there are some coal mines in operation, and there are some people there who are still making decent money at very dangerous work.
Yeah.
The vast majority of people there are working at minimum wage. And in fact, Molly, in the very first of the book, Molly is working two jobs, one at Walmart and one at one of the fast food chains, McDonald's, and she has she's a single mother with three children, and she's typical of life in Welsh, West Virginia.
Yeah, well, I can't believe that. I mean, she's typical of a lot of single mothers and single fathers in this country. A lot of people and couples are sharing like maybe three jobs between them just to keep going.
Exactly.
So I know a young woman in a city in Indiana who she's, I believe, 19, and she's working three jobs. And I asked her, I said, well, you're saving for school or something? And she said, no. She said, they're all part-time, and I need them to live.
Yeah.
So, that's just a single young woman. Somebody with kids, it's like, wow, yeah. So I can see that. And then you're saying 40% are getting some type of aid. I could sure see that. I don't know what the percentage is for the country flat across. Do you, Jerry?
I don't have that in my head. I'm sorry, but it is high. Okay. There's no question for the working poor, this is a typical story. And the working poor has become a larger class than we're a major class in this country.
Yes. Oh, definitely. And I think that people are maybe beginning to realize that, we used to think, well, middle class covered quite an area. And a lot of people didn't want to admit being, of the poor economic class. So they would just say, well, maybe, lower middle class, whatever. And now it's just people are just flat out, poor. It's, because so many people are, and there's no disgrace in it. I don't know. Do you talk in the book a lot about unions?
There isn't much left of the unions in Welsh, and so that's where the story takes place.
Mm-hmm.
With the collapse of the coal industry, that pretty much
United
Mine Workers of America still has an office there, but it's really not very functional.
Yeah.
It was certainly the union certainly had credit for the prosperous times of the 60s and the 70s, but and not only in Welsh, but in the country, unionism has become less and less of a factor.
Yes.
Back in the 50, 60s and 70s in the country, one in three workers belonged to some union or other. Now that's down to about 10%. And along with that collapse of unions has come the collapse of economic prosperity for the working class. I'm not saying that you have to belong to a union in order to be successful as a working person, but you do really need to have some voice in the economic process. And in this country, we've not just lost the strength of the union voice, we have lost the strength
totally.
Of the public voice, of the voting voice, because
totally.
the robber barons of today have basically purchased democracy.
Well, they have. And, you know, you gave a figure of maybe 10% of the workers in this country, and that's very high, actually, to what I've heard recently was more like 6 or 7%. So, but it's way lower than it should be. And people need to remember that the unions, because I used to be one of those people who said, well, you know, the unions, yeah, they did all these things. I mean, they got the kids out of the sweatshops and they got, you know, wages up and health care and on. So it's like, so why do we still need them? But then it's like, oh, wow, why we need them is we're regressing right back to those times again.
Yes, and, absolutely.
Yeah, so we
and
really
not, you know,
need...
One of the things that I need convince myself of, or to remind myself of, I guess I should say, is that it isn't just the working poor we're talking about. We're talking about anybody who draws a paycheck, anyone
mm-hmm.
who is dependent on their jobs in order to maintain the lifestyle that they have at whatever level. And so the issue of economic injustice in this country is not just about the working poor. It's about the working.
Exactly. And we're not talking, I mean, because, of course, the CEOs of major corporations would say, well, I work so hard. I mean, and we're not talking about them because they're drawing what? $23,000 an hour or something, or, I mean, some of them more than that. You know, I just read recently where more than half the people in this country earn in a year less than $25,000. So,
yeah.
You know, when you
and
say, that, okay.
And that's the working poor. That's $25,000 is less than minimum, less than, it's less than the poverty point.
Well, yeah, I mean, if they've got a kid or two, it definitely is. But so when over half the people are earning that or less than that, and then you hear of some guy who in an hour, you know, is making that off of the sweat and labor of these people, you know there's something really, really wrong here.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
what,
you know, I'm not big on statistics, but the CEO of Walmart makes in a minute more than all of its employees make in an hour.
Isn't that ridiculous? And then you think for the there was a town in Ohio. And we read about that online during the wintertime where at Walmart, the employees were asked if they could to bring food for other employees who, you know, were going to have a rough Christmas, a rough holiday. And then also we hear about some of the Walmarts, as soon as you're hired on, they show you how to fill out the form so you'll be able to get but SNAP, which is like food stamps
exactly.
or other help. And it's
exactly.
disgraceful. that a company...
That's the business. You see, that's the business model of Walmart and most of the major chains in this country. That's the business model.
Yeah.
In wealth, it works wonderful, you know, because 40% of the people are on SNAP.
Yeah. See that.
And here comes the vultures.
Well, that's horror, though, because in the first place, a lot of towns, a lot of businesses are put out of business by Walmart in the first place. And
yes,
so, you know,
exactly.
People were making a decent wage working for their neighbor or for themselves or whatever. Well, then that goes. Then they're down some poor minimum wage and not getting benefits because they won't hire them for 40 hours. And so the government actually helped Walmart come to some places. So they're helping them. They're helping them with, you know, they get all these tax breaks. And yet they won't even give their employees enough to feed themselves. So,
exactly.
And then you know, think about where so many goods that Walmart sells come from. It's not like you're going to see these are made in America or made in Canada or something. They're made in sweatshops, Bangladesh, these clothes, the garment factories where people are locked in and burned to death. It's an immoral company to begin with. And I really don't think that Sam Walton had this in mind.
I've heard that that's so, that Sam Walton absolutely did not have what Walmart has become in mind.
Right. That was not, I've read that he was a good man and probably has turned over so many times in his grave that he's, you know, at what his children and other people have done with his company. But, I know people who just will not shop there. And, I mean, this is just an example. We're using Walmart because it's the biggest retailer in the world, I believe,
exactly.
If not the, at least close.
It's our whipping boy.
So it's, it's huge. We know this. And as soon as the country gets to Walmart, it's like, well, you know, it's going down because but I know people who just won't go there for anything. And I wish that I could be that way. I live in a small town currently, and there isn't any here, but I don't know, 20, 30 miles in a couple different directions there is, and there's not a lot of choice. Sometimes I have to shop there. I always hate it. I go in, get what I really need, and get out because even the atmosphere is not good. And
you've actually described, you've just told me you live in Welch.
Okay. Right.
Let me tell you, this is the whole scene that I'm trying to create in a novel in Welch, West Virginia. Now it's not the coal barons that are abusing the town. It is Walmart and it is McDonald's and it is other fast food chains that have come to town and actually been supported in it by the local government.
Yes.
Believing that somehow or other this is going to be good for the town, not realizing that what they're doing is destroying further the economy of the town.
Right. It's
and
because
you're
of
right. It gets to the point, especially in a small town, where there are no alternatives, and so everybody just goes to Walmart. They have to. There's no other game in town.
Yes.
This is where Walmart is different, and I suspect that it's different in a lot of towns like Welch, and that is that there is another grocery store in Welch. There is another hardware store in Welch. It is difficult to buy clothing in Welch, but there is at least a remnant of competition left there. And what Molly Jones is going to do is to get the people in the town to realize that every dollar they spend is a vote. It's a vote for Walmart. It's a vote for economic greed. It's a vote for money to go to offshore, and it's sucking the town once again. It's sucking the economy of the town once again out somewhere else. And so, one of the things Molly's going to do is she's going to get everybody to stop going to Walmart. She's going to empty the Walmart parking lot. She's going to empty the McDonald's parking lot, and everybody's going to start going to the local business. And she's got and she has a way of making this happen. And when I say that this story has to be practical and it has to be credible, and she has a practical and credible way to turn that situation around. But she needs the small business community, that which is still in business and that which is still there and probably on food stamps.
Right.
She's got to get that local economy moving again.
Well, you know, and that's going to be quite a job for her, because, like you said, there's another hardware store, another food store. The thing is, those stores, they charge more than Walmart, because Walmart buys in such a huge quantity. And the people, poor people, of course, try to seek out the most inexpensive of things. So,
I'm not even sure that that's true. I know that's what we think. And in cases, I think you can make a case for it. But let me talk about the hardware store.
Okay.
The hardware store is in a buying co-op called True Value Hardware. That's not a chain. You know, that's a buying co-op for independent hardware stores. And that hardware store in real life is perfectly capable of competing on price.
Okay.
It is possible to do, but first you have to have business. And if the business is all going someplace else,
right,
then, you know, you can't compete. It's a chicken or egg thing, I understand, but somehow or other you've got to change the buying habits of people around. And, you know, some people can afford another 10 cents on something or 20 cents
exactly.
on something.
Exactly.
And if they were to spend 10 or 20 cents more on something, pretty soon the economy of the town would turn around and people would be at work, having jobs, and the money would be flowing, And everybody would see prosperity again for themselves as well as for the community. There's no question that will work.
I live in a very small community, and there is one grocery store, and I try. It is some things are quite a bit more expensive, but you know I'm a perimeter. I eat fruits and vegetables, and so I will spend maybe a little bit more. When they have what I need, then I would spend at a Walmart. And I do that gladly because I know that they're paying much more than Walmart is paying. And so it's there's a lot of individual stores in small towns especially that is trying to make it, and it's very, very hard on them.
Yeah.
Because if they're not part of, like you were talking about, True Value Hardware being a like a co-op, a buy-in for the chain kind of thing. If people aren't involved in something like that, they just don't have that. You know, we know, you know, just on the basic whatever, something is $1 for one or two for $5. You know, people always like the more you get, the cheaper it is. And so, of course, that happens in retail stores. So it is something to be concerned about. And I've seen most of the people I know that I know personally, are they're going to save that 10 cents. And they hate what they're doing, but they don't have the extra $5 or $6 shopping trip to spend So they're going to go where it is the cheapest, where they can get everything they need, and it's cheaper. And there are still, you know, some, it was like you were saying, who don't mind when they can spending the extra 10 or 20 cents. But, and that will add up, too. So, like you said, I mean, it adds up for the person who's spending it, but it will add up for the store also.
Yeah. You know, there's no question in my mind, and I'm not too far away from poverty myself. And certainly my daughter has been there and done that, and I know that it's very difficult to make ends meet, and you've got to be very careful with your money. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't think that the majority of us have that problem. And if the majority of, but we do have the problem around us of collapsing communities. And you know, I can't help but think, and certainly that's the big issue in fighting the issue on the economic front, whether or not you can get people to be responsible when they have a choice. And we don't.
Yes,
right,
sir,
now. There's no question that we don't. All we're willing to do is to complain about the rich people without thinking about where the rich people got their money. All we can do now is to complain about the rich people buying our democracy, you know, buying our congressmen and our senators, and we think that we're doing something. Well, that's not, you know, we don't have much. Our dog won't hunt in that fight, as we West Virginians would say.
Right.
We're
right.
Way outmanned at that level. But
well,
when
you
we're
know,
talking about our pocketbook, we've got some control over that.
Well, I the two things are, you know, it's very hard. If you say somebody who is, you know, pretty much at the poverty level, now say that they shop maybe four or five stores during the week, and each place they're going to spend $5 or $6 more by doing it this way. That adds up to $100 or more a month, which they don't have. They can't do it.
Yeah, no kidding.
The other thing I would say, though, is, you know, people really need, I think, to start checking themselves and what they're buying and asking, you know, why am I getting this? Is this going to improve the quality of my life? It's, you know, in America, especially in the United States, people have fallen into that trap of believing all this crap they see on TV, as far as the commercials and things. They think they need the latest colored dress, whatever, the latest kind of blue jeans. You know, blue jeans are blue jeans, except they're really not, but there's not that much difference. And, you know, they think they need 20 pairs. Well, you don't. This kind of thing, they're taught that if you spend money, you're going to be happy. And your happiness is very fleeting. If you're going to spend money on something, is it going to bring you joy? Is it going to make you smile? Is it going to improve your life? I think that we've been asking wrong questions or putting emphasis on the wrong thing. So one thing
do
we
you
can
know
do,
where, do you know where you're getting that info, where you're getting those ideas? On television.
Well, I'm not.
Who buys the commercials? Well, the guys that are wanting to get it in your pocket.
Well, sure. I mean, that exactly. That's what I'm saying. But people, you know, people are not inherently stupid, but they're so unhappy. Like we talked at the beginning of the show, when, you know, they think that, well, I have no power. So I'm just going to give up and sit and watch the TV, the black box. So then, but they fall into that. Of course, that commercial comes on and on and on. If you have this car, you know, you're really hot stuff. The women are going to flock to you. And somebody who can't even pay the rent is going to manage somehow to get a loan and then be paying off this car they don't need. And I know people with mobile homes and boats that they may use twice a year, and they're making payments because the guy down the street has this, and so they think that they have to also. Now, so
well,
this
let,
is what
let me just add to that. You mentioned before the middle class, and of course the system has divided the middle class up into lower middle and upper middle class. Divide and conquer is part of the process. Here's the thing about the middle class. In the past 15 years, the middle class has begun to feel like the lower class because lost their homes. They've been overextended. They've been suckered into extending themselves way beyond their means.
Yes.
And now all of a sudden it's being called back. And
yes.
I'm not absolving them of the responsibility, but I am saying that that's part of the problem, and I think it's intentional.
Oh, it is. I totally agree with you. It is. And, see, I'm like you, though. I don't absolve them of the whole thing because we're not born stupid. But we have allowed ourselves as a group to become dumbed down, I think, by propaganda, by the mainstream media, the commercials, all of this. And so, yeah, people have fallen for this. And, you know, back when people were getting loans on homes, that there was no way their income was like $1,200 a month and the mortgage was $1,500. Somehow they managed to get the house. And then, of course, they lost it. I mean, you know, it's like, where was their brain? That you can't just, I mean, they were willing, the suckers, like you said before. I mean, they were willing because it was something they wanted. And so they believed something. They chose to believe what they knew wasn't true. So
people... Well, it's hard to look at them as victims, but I do. I do look at them as victims, just as much as they've been taught,
have
been brainwashed into believing that they need designer jeans.
Yes, yes.
And it's gotten us into trouble.
Yes, but it is intentional. I agree with you because, you know, how can you have a slave class without slaves? So...
Exactly. And you know what? I think it's wonderful. And one of the things that I'm really very careful about is I don't like to talk about economic equality, okay? Mm-hmm. Economic equality kind of means to me like socialism, and I'm not interested in that. You know, I want people to have the opportunity to get rich. Okay, I think all of us ought to have the opportunity. All of us aren't going to make it, but we all ought to have the opportunity, and we don't.
Well, I also think that way, too. But every person that I have seen that is wealthy has got there on the backs of other people who were kept down. And so the opportunity, I would like just the opportunity for people to have homes, jobs that they liked, and plenty of time for their creative life and for their friends and family, you know, without worrying about that roof over their head or their kids' health care or something. You know, our health care, my goodness, Jerry, in this country, as I understand it, at one time, I mean, we had the best in so many areas, not just health care, but, you know, prenatal care, and we didn't have, I don't want to say, like our babies lived and yada, yada, yada. But now the U.S. is way down on the list for so many things.
Yes, so it is, especially in developed countries. We're at the bottom of the developed countries on many issues.
Yes. And I mean, we're aware of that, but so many people in this country aren't aware of that because they still they believe the propaganda about the U.S. being the leader in all these areas.
Yep.
So it's there's a lot of work to do to get people away from that TV. Does Molly does she address like propaganda, mainstream media on these issues?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
In your book, will Molly be addressing propaganda and things like that, mainstream media, these ideas?
I'm up to chapter 15 in the book. It'll have about 40.
Oh, okay.
To this point, she has had to first rise up out of her tragic life. She's had to get over the loss of her infant child because of the lack of health care, because she did not have coverage, because she was working two jobs and didn't have benefits. You know, she's got to get through all that, and then she's got to begin thinking about what she's going to do with her life. So
mm-hmm.
all of this, she's working her way through to chapter 15, and we're now at the point where she begins to take action. She understands the problem very well. She's not, as you say, she's not stupid.
Yeah.
In fact, she was college bound before all this happened to her, and it was a family decision that her brother get to go to college and become a doctor first, and then she would go second, you see. And so she's very bright, and she's learned a lot on the Internet. And her mother was a teacher, and her teacher knew that she wasn't learning all she needed to know in school, and so she homeschooled her. So we're talking here about a very, very smart poor person.
Yeah, right.
And all of that needs to be developed before she begins to, you know, go to work on the problem.
Right.
But, and what you said to me, you know, that's very important, because, and one of the reasons why I'm enjoying collaborating with people on the group We Are the Market Force, because they're giving me all kinds of good ideas how the rest of this story can unfold.
Yeah. Well, that's what, I mean, I like what you've been saying so far, because she's really tackling, I mean, she's in Welch, West Virginia, but what she's facing is straight across the wide plains of America. And so I think it's going to be one of those books that everybody can relate to.
Well, I certainly think so. But again, a lot of people can't relate to the poor working or not.
Yeah.
And so it really has to appeal to more than just that the lowest of the economic front. And that's why it has to reach out to the middle class, to all of us, to the 98%, so they say, or 99% sometimes.
99.9 or something, yeah.
Well, it has to relate to all of us, not just to the working poor. And,
right. Well, tell me, you mentioned that this may be ready at the end of the year.
Yes, I'd hope to have it done in September. It was September last year that the first, it's a Hellraiser book, and the first Hellraiser came out in September of this year, and I'd hope to do the same. But I've gotten so deeply involved in the real We Are the Market Force, I'm having a hard time working on the book. I'm now shooting for January or February.
Ah, okay. And so, realistically, then maybe January, February. How can people get your first book?
Okay, you can get it on Amazon.com or any of the online booksellers. It is not in bookstores. This is a self-published book, and bookstores just don't carry them.
Okay.
You can get it on my website, which is www.jerryash.com. And you can buy a book there and get me to autograph it. So it's pretty easy to find. It's, you know, the name of the book is Hellraiser, Mother Jones, and Historical Novel.
Okay, and that can be found at www.jerryash.com.
Correct.
Or you can.
And then, of course, on Facebook, I really would like to hear some, find some of your listeners joining us or at least visiting us. And you know, the it's you can just go on Facebook and just put in, you know, the name We Are the Market Force,
right?
And you can find us there. We started just less than 2 months ago, about a month and a half ago. We've got 400 members already.
Yeah, no, I'll be posting that on Aramarte's video page also. What kind of advice would you give to our listeners for somebody who's saying, well, okay, you know, this Molly sounds like she's got it together, and I'm not dumb, so what can I do? What would you tell them?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, watch where your money goes. You know, all of your, whatever the issue you have, social, political, or economic, if you just stop to think of it, the root of the evil, whatever it is money.
It's money is energy. And so wherever you're going to put your energy, I mean, that's where your thoughts, that's where everything is going to go.
Yeah, you know, it starts right here with yourself, you know. And you know, one of the things I keep saying to people is, you know, don't wait for the next election to make yourself heard. You can do it every day by the decisions that you make in your spending habits.
That is really good advice. It's just check yourself. Think about it. Do I really want this? Do I have to have it now? Can I wait and get it from like an independent store in a couple weeks or something? That's important. We're not telling people not to buy. We're just saying be careful where you buy from.
No, that's exactly right. And I'm not crazy, you know. If I have to go to Walmart to buy something, I will. But it's the last choice.
And I'm not going to beat up on myself, though, if I do. You know, we can't beat up on ourselves. They, those in power, would love that, for us to beat up on each other and ourselves. So we can't.
You know what will happen to you if you start saying, well, I'm not going to go to Walmart unless I have to. You're going
then
to
you
have
to
everything. Less and less and less.
This is, yeah, well, that's it. I mean, it's like, okay, if you talk about it, okay, but if you say, I never will, then it's like, okay, well, yeah. That's it. I don't go that often, and like I said, I go in and get out because I don't like it.
You know, I rather would like to put this in a positive rather than a negative way, and I'm sitting here listening to myself and saying, no, this is not what I want to say. I want to say, you know, when you have a choice, buy local. When you have a choice, buy from a good employer. When
exactly.
you have a choice, you know, make your money stay in town.
Right. And from somebody who actually cares about their employees and is building a community, that's excellent. So I'm going to say goodbye now. Thank you so much, Jerry. JerryAsh.com, also on Facebook, We Are the Market Force. And we will be talking to you when your new Molly book comes, I hope.
Yes, I'd love that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ruthanne.
Okay. Bye-bye, Jared.
Bye-bye.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. And we are back with Alexander Lepan in Amsterdam. Hi, Alexander.
Hello, Ruthann.
Hey, thank you so much for staying up and doing this live. I know it's 2 a.m.
Well, it's all right.
It's, but I really, really appreciate it. So, my friend, you have recently been in Ukraine, and you went there for a couple of reasons. You told me that, you know, very seldom do you get to see a state being born, and also you really wanted the truth of what is happening there. How were you able to go?
Yes, well, let me explain you. I'm an international lawyer and civil journalist, and I am also a head of external relations for a political movement called Green Socialism. So we've been busy with many socially oriented movements all over the world, in Venezuela, in Cuba, in Libya, and especially during military conflicts in these countries or during people's unrest. And it was very interesting for me to see what was really going on in East Ukraine. It depends from your point of view whether you call it East Ukraine or you call it Donetsk People's Republic, as it is called now. But yes, for me as a researcher, one of the topics was to see how a new state was being born, because that's something you do not see on a daily basis. And it is also interesting to be in the middle of that. And the second part was, well, as you might analyze different media sources, there are different truths to it.
Mm-hmm.
So one media source would say something completely opposite of another one. And it was interesting for me to actually witness what is truly going on there on the ground and, where the real truth lies. So.
Well, now, were you already acquainted with people there? I mean, some socialists or social organizations, socialists, like you said, the Green Socialism, and did you know people when you went?
Well, of course, you do not go into a war conflict without knowing.
But I hope, yes. Yeah, okay.
So, yes. And especially what was really interesting for me is that perhaps when you listened to the, maybe you, I don't know how you followed the conflict from the beginning, the story is that in the central Kiev, in the central capital, the old president got kicked out for corruption and other purposes. And the original idea was that people would grab power. Yet people didn't grab power. Other oligarchs grabbed power with the help of a number of nationalistic groups. So basically a number of very rich oligarchs paid for nationalist groups which are skilled in street fighting, and they took over governmental buildings. And even more fun about it is that there were not really new people in this so-called revolution. It's all same old people who seized power. So for the West, from the outside, it looks like there is a new government, but in fact, nobody is new. They've been sitting there for 20 years. They were main bankers. They were main private owners, and they were old politicians who've been there for many years.
Well,
so
okay, go ahead.
But the main problem is they had this nationalistic groups under them, which had to be quietened and or shown. So they disallowed a number of privileges for East Ukrainian people, like for example the Russian language and cultural values. And those people in East Ukraine first did not like that because, well, if you can't speak your own native language, then you can't participate in the political life of your country.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part is that, people in East Ukraine saw that it's not really a people's revolution, so they decided to well, as they proclaimed, to take power into their own hands. And this is how this civil unrest was born. When they start taking governmental buildings, they had many of this leftist ideas and speeches and proposals like nationalization of local property. So it kind of became interesting for us as well. So we knew it's not like some oligarchic takeover, but it is something that's coming from beneath. And this is the part that got interesting for us to get involved.
Well, as I understood it, the one of the reasons for the takeover, overthrow, whatever, was because the U.S. and the West didn't seem to be hitting it off real well with the president. And so that they wanted these other people who are, well, like you said, well, they're fanatical maybe, more fascist, more nationalistic, like the West. They thought that they would get along with them better. Is this true?
You mean when they overthrew their old president?
Yes.
Yes. The old president had this course of a pro-Russian policy. In any case, let's say like this. The man was really corrupt.
Right.
And he wasn't really a pro-Russian leader, as he was trying to sit on two chairs. From one side, he was flirting with Russia, and you might imagine that all East Ukraine industry is aimed at Russia, because all machine building, all coal, all mine shafts are all producing for Russia. So the whole East Ukraine depends on Russian markets.
Let me, before you, also, are they in East Ukraine? Aren't they building some parts for, like, spaceships and space travel?
Yes, yes, they are, and for trains and for heavy machinery.
Right.
All that is being bought by Russia.
Yes.
Europe doesn't buy Russian rock parts, let's say it very bluntly.
Yeah.
And another part is that the same president, he was trying to blackmail Russia by getting very close to a European Association Treaty, which would mean that Ukraine would open its borders to the European markets.
And the EU and all of that?
Yes, it's called European Association Treaty because it would be like a kind of like a WTO between Europe and Ukraine. And, well, he used this double position in order to get credits from both Russia as from Europe. But as you know, if you try to sit on two chairs, in the end you will fall down through the chairs.
Yes.
And this is what happened to him in the end, because he neither could accept the European Association Treaty, because it would cost him the economy of East Ukraine. And at the same time, got lots of people in West Ukraine angry because he promised them to enter Europe, but he didn't. So that's one of the reasons why the people in Kiev went out against him.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
So you can imagine that a normal person who would go on the barricade in Kiev, well, you have your work, you have your obligations. You can stand there for 1 or 2 days, but in the end you go home.
Mm.
Because that's a poor country, you can't sit there for ages. So the regular people, they came and they left. But the real backbone of this political overthrow in Kiev were real organized nationalist groups. Because if you can only sit there for weeks and fight only if you're being paid. Otherwise, as I said,
you're
going
to starve. I mean, yeah, you have to have some kind of support.
Yes. So that support was financed a lot by Western media with the idea that it would become a pro-Western overthrow. Well, in the end, you can consider those politicians pro-Western, because that's the only idea that separates them from Russia. The whole nationalist self-value. How can I explain it? There's not much difference between a Russian and a Ukrainian. More or less, these are the same people. It would be, as I would imagine, you being the same difference between a person from New York and a person from Texas. You know, there are some differences, there are some historical differences, but in the end, there are same basic values between the people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the end, they need something to separate themselves in order to justify their power and their positions. And this is what they found in this nationalism and the whole anti-Russian mood. This is basically what happened in Kyiv and what is going on. If you're interested more in the backbone or in the backstory of Ukraine, there are lots of videos on YouTube. You can watch that. I guess for our debate of today, it would be much more interesting for you to hear about the situation and the civil war in East Ukraine.
Right. But I also, you mentioned YouTube. I want to say that you have a channel. It's Alexander L. on YouTube.
Yes, Alexander L. or Alexander Lipen. You can watch that. Those are videos that I filmed directly in Donetsk during the referendum of independence. Because these are more or less opinions of local people. They are a lot in Russian. I didn't yet have time to get subtitles on that. But in fact, it's some kind of proof of what I have seen personally on the ground.
Yes. When you were there, I'm not quite sure when you were there. Were you there when that fire, when people were burned alive?
Yes, when the people were burned alive, I was the first day in East Ukraine.
Oh my goodness.
Were burned alive not there, but in another part of Ukraine, in south. If you imagine Ukraine as a country, you should see it more as in the West, they are more Ukrainian national and they speak purely Ukrainian. In the East, most of them speak Russian.
Right.
The country is a double language. And in the South, like in Odessa, it's a mixture because it's between Krim and Odessa. It was semi-Russian, semi-Ukrainian culture.
Mm-hmm.
So when the eastern provinces started separating themselves because they're predominantly Russian,
right.
In Odessa, there was a double mood. Part of the people tried to come up against the central government in Kyiv, against the nationalism, but with a thought to stay inside Ukraine. And the leaders in the government in Kyiv organized the nationalist militias, which went into the city and drove a couple of hundred of people into the building and burned them alive. Yes. And when they tried to escape the building, they were being shot at.
Yes.
Very dramatic and tragic occurrence. Still being researched, yet it's being researched by the same government which organized it, so you can imagine that you will never...
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of the same thing as here in the U.S., the commission to check into the Kennedy assassination or into 9/11, you know, it's just bogus. When you first hear, oh, they're going to look into it, and then you find out who's looking into it, you know, it's worthless. So that's just sad. But that was the horrible thing. I think that was one of the things that got people in the West, I don't know, it really caught their attention. But I think that so many people in the West, again, they believe the mainstream media, which is all asked backwards, so they really don't know what's going on. That's why I was happy to have you come and talk about what you actually saw. How long did you get to stay there, Alexander?
I've been there for 2 weeks.
2 weeks, okay. And you were in Kyiv, but did you travel around?
No, I was not in Kyiv. I was in Donetsk.
Okay.
Kyiv is the capital city at the moment. Not much is happening there. I was actually in one of the provinces which declared independence from Kyiv. This is an important part to realize, because this is the interesting thing. It actually reminds me, and if to compare it to your audience, with the Declaration of Independence of the United States.
Okay.
Because there is a passage in there, something about when the long train of abuse of a government leaves people to absolute despotism, it is your right and it is your duty to throw off such a government and install your own new government. Well, it's about something like this, right? So it's one of the basic documents of Western democracy.
Well, that that is the patriotic. I mean, that is what you're supposed to do. You're not being a rebel just to be it. I mean, this is your duty, your responsibility.
Yes, and this is what many people actually in East Ukraine felt, as I noticed from my... I took about 20 interviews on the streets from people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
And, most people feel like there is a new government which is corrupt, and there is a certain number of violations by this government which would not be accepted by the people in East Ukraine.
Right.
We talked about cultural and national discrimination. I talked about the language factor. Because, you know, from one side, it sounds simple. You know, well, if you're not allowed to speak Russian, you just speak Ukrainian. It's not a big of a deal. But, in fact, you cannot go to court. You cannot call the police in that language. You cannot vote because the voting billet is no longer in Russian. So it is a kind of big of a deal.
It is a big deal. That is a big deal.
The second part is that the cultural background, for example, monuments of Second World War, were being destroyed by nationalist groups.
Wow.
And as you imagine, most people in East Ukraine had relatives who fought in the Second World War against Hitler. It's a part of self-value. It's a part of basic values that you learn. And suddenly you are told that your grandfather, who fought against Hitler, was an occupying fascist. And this is being taught in schools. You know, you don't accept that. It's part of who you are.
Right. You don't take that away from someone.
And they disallowed the 9th of May. And if you might imagine, 9th of May is the victory day in most Russia, Ukraine, East Europe. It's the biggest celebration there is. It's like Christmas in the United States. And suddenly, if you celebrate the 9th of May, you're an extremist.
Oh, wow.
So I was there on the 9th of May, and it was a very dramatic scene, because people self-organized 9th of May. They created protection militias, which would control the whole city, because they were afraid that Ukrainian army would drive into the city and shoot at people. And this actually happened in one of the southern cities, in Mariupol. The army drove into the city and killed around 20 people.
Oh.
During a parade, but in Donetsk, in the capital of the region, they were able to protect themselves, and you would actually see people, like in the times of Second World War in the Soviet Union, you would see husbands and brothers, they would arm themselves, and they would go directly to front, and women would throw flowers at them, and it's something, you know, you see that, I've seen those things in the movies, Right. About sex. I never imagined that I would see something like that directly in real life, right. where men, just normal, regular men from that city, go to war directly from this parade.
Wow.
You know, we're used to parades which are basically a reflection of the past. And here,
yeah.
You see women crying and they just ask for the men to come home and those things. You know, this is also a part of a real civil war. You know, we see wars in movies where you just, the Hollywoodization of wars, you know,
sure.
A lot of bullets and a lot of blood and violence and whatever. But the greatest suffering in the civil war is the psychological pressure on the people. This is, you feel a lot. You know, I talked to the main doctor there. I took an interview. And you know which medicines they do not have. There's a shortage of medicines. How you really see that it's a civil war.
Penicillin.
No.
What?
No. No, penicillin, it's things you need for soldiers. You know the greatest shortage they had at the time?
What?
It was things to lower blood pressure.
Oh, my God.
Because...
Sure.
As you may imagine, many people are over 50 and 60.
And very stressed now.
And they go to war, and there are many of their wives, and this is real medicine that you are short of in a civil war.
That's,
you know, blood pressure, heart medicines, those things. Besides the fact that, how would you call it, national psychological pressure and all, yes, it's
sure.
called psychosis. People are suffering from that.
Well, sort of that post-traumatic stress disorder that we hear about so much after people come back from the wars and different things. But it happens, I guess, I mean, you've got the stress going on right during it. But that is so, wow, that's heart-wrenching, what you saw as far as the parades and the women throwing the flowers and the guys going right from the parade off to fight. You're right. We never thought we would see that. I mean, that's from the movies. But
yes.
And, yeah.
You know, I actually never thought that I would be in the center of those things. You know, we have all these international laws on genocide and human rights violations. And you can imagine this is also a country in the middle of Europe. So Ukraine was one of rich countries inside Soviet Union. It had all the industry and production.
Mm-hmm.
And it was culturally very developed country. So we're talking about the country... in the middle of Europe, it's not like some African tribal conflict where...
It wasn't a third world situation at all. No.
No, and suddenly you have like real fascist occurrences going on there. For example, a city blockaded and they were not able to bring in insulin for a couple of weeks. It actually took time. They were not able to negotiate being under siege to bring in humanitarian aid. This is a direct war crime. They were not able to evacuate civilians from the city. And civil neighborhoods were being bombed by mortars.
Wow.
There is a number of real war crimes being done by Central Kyiv government. And... it's like Central Kyiv government doesn't know that it is the 21st century. It's like they have this feeling that they can do it without being punished. Like they can always flee to the United States and Uncle Sam will cover for them.
Exactly.
And you know what? I also feel like there's a number of double standards. For example, today Obama... decided to provide aid to the Syrian rebels of $500 million.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you have enough money in the United States, because I've been to a couple of your cities like Detroit. I think it would be much better to spend it on that.
Thank you. Exactly. yeah, we have 1 in 4 kids going to bed hungry. We have all these people homeless. Our infrastructure is pretty much for shit. I mean, it's just old. It needs repair. So, no, obviously, the money is being spent totally wrong. I mean, to go kill people. And when you know that the U.S. and other countries back the ISIS, and then they're backing them, they're giving money to the people to fight them. It's one of those things. They're supporting everybody except their own country. It's such a mismanagement. I don't know how much money, how much more we can give away, okay? I don't know.
Well, you do print the money, so you can give it away endlessly.
Well, the Federal Reserve does, which is not the same as the U.S. government, but, of course, they're in the same bed. Yeah. Let me apologize for my neighbor's dog, Alexander. There's really nothing I can do. I don't have air conditioning, and I have windows open in my studio. And the neighbor's dog, well, I have the second floor of a flat. The neighbors have a dog out in front of their house who occasionally, like tonight, is, I guess, trying to say hello to everything that moves. So I just want to apologize.
Well, it's all right. you don't even have to explain it.
Well, I didn't want you to think it was mine, because if I had one, it would be better behaved. But my cats don't talk much. They just, jump around. So, but I'm sorry. The dog is just being a dog out there, and he doesn't really realize that I would like for him to be quiet sometimes. So.
No, but, for me, it was more like the idea of double standards itself. For example,
yes,
you take two exactly opposite situations, like the Syrian rebels, which fight against a legitimate regime,
yes,
in Syria,
yeah,
and let's call them rebels in East Ukraine, which fight against a corrupt regime in Kyiv. So
yes,
what happens? The rebels in East Ukraine are enemies and terrorists,
yes,
and the central government is financed. And the Syrian rebels are financed in the opposite way. So it's a contradiction. If you make one policy, then you should either finance central governments or finance all the rebels, isn't it?
Well, the policy is they will support whoever will kiss U.S. ass.
Yes.
Sorry, but that's the policy. So whether you're called a rebel or a hero or whatever in your own land, if you will succumb to the U.S., you will have support. But, those countries better give it a second thought. The U.S. supported Saddam. They've supported many of the guys in the Banana Republics in Latin America. And once those people did one thing that the U.S. didn't like, they turned on them. So, just having U.S. support doesn't mean that it's all going to be great for you, because you're going to pay the price.
Yes. Well, yes. So, the from a leftist perspective, I have learned a lot as well, because we read a lot of things in books, like what to do when you start a revolution, or mm-hmm, theoretical things,
Right.
But there's a lot of practical things that we have never thought about. And I don't mean a revolution only where you grab power by force, because as I listened to my colleague in your radio show just before me, you can also grab power by election or
yes,
by popular vote. You do not need to be illegal. For example, we have a great example of Chavez, who just won the elections. But this is where it gets complicated, because as I found out, we, the leftists,
mm-hmm,
we lack professional cadre for middle management. You know,
yes.
you can nationalize a bank, but who will lead the bank department? Who will lead the bank itself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very interesting to talk about the working man will take power in his own hands, but you need still to be able to understand something in higher economics or in mathematics or in whatever.
Exactly.
And this is a great problem inside each people's popular uprising, is that there's a lack of higher professional cadre. And this is something that we need to take notice of for future, because, in order to solve a problem, you need to recognize a problem.
And we know that there has to be somebody who will be able to step into that position, because a void doesn't stay a void for long. If there is a void, an overthrow of a government, somebody's going to come in, and it may be worse than what you had before. So somebody has to be ready to, a group has to be ready to step in there.
Well, the thing is about Donetsk even, we are used in thinking, and this is also part of Hollywood as well, we are used in thinking of this one hero idea, you know, from zero to hero, and then one man solves it all.
Yeah.
In reality, it's such a huge and vast situation that it's even hard to imagine how many people are working in different administrative and leading and calculating roles. It's not even maybe tens of thousands need.
Yes.
Even to organize a people's referendum, you know, I thought, well, perhaps it's like a couple of voting rooms, you know, and then people can come in and vote. For example, Donetsk is a city of 1 million people. The whole region is around 2.5 million, I believe. And all those people need to vote for the referendum of independence. At the time, there were nationalistic groups which were driving around the province, shooting at people in the streets, just to terrorize them, not to go to referendum. There was also Ukrainian army from the central government driving towards the cities, and there were people holding it off in the trenches. And basically, you need to organize a couple of hundred voting rooms so that people can come in to vote there.
Sure.
You need to print several million voting billets. You need to have people to drive those billets around. You need protection of civil guards for each voting room.
Station, right.
Because it's not a civil vote. Any moment a guerrilla or a terrorist group can come in and bomb the place, which actually happened. A couple of people lost their lives because they tried to set up election, but they got shot for that.
Wow.
Still, I believe something like 75 or 80% came to vote.
Wow. Okay.
And this is because in one of the cities, the election had to be broken up prematurely because of military coming too close to that city and shooting a couple of people. And from those 75 or 80%, 90% voted for their independence. So you can imagine from those millions of people, it is a great amount of people.
Yes.
And you can imagine how huge the work was to organize all of that.
Yes. I mean, that's people don't understand, and that's what I think about in this country. I mean, so many of us really want a revolution, and it's like, okay, it may come in a different way than we want because we just don't have, the left groups here are not organized. They won't seem to work together. And so as far as getting, you know, I've thought often about, well, so what if, you know, people want to just like take over the capital? It's like, well, that's not going to do anything, you know, but make a big mess. People don't think ahead. They just think, oh, we're just going to overpower something. and they don't think like you're talking about all these people who had to work to make this voting happen. And these are the silent heroes, really. I mean, the people who, and just like you said, a couple people lost their lives doing it. A lot of people don't realize what goes into it.
Yes, and this is just organization of a referendum, but
yeah.
You must also run the whole country after that. Like,
right.
Organizing factories and production and banking system, which is another huge problem, because this is something we never thought about.
Yeah.
Ruth, in 1917, when, for example, Lenin took over power, or a number of socialists like in Cuba, what do? You nationalize a bank and all the money and all the gold is inside, right?
Right.
But these days, there's nothing inside the bank.
That's true. It's international banking. Right. The bank is just a facade. So how do you change that?
Even more, it's an electronic system which can be switched off from a distance.
Right.
So if they don't like what you do, you have a couple of million, and in the case of United States, 200 million people who not only can get paid for their wages or buy food, but basically all the money disappears.
Yeah.
So if they want, they can cause chaos with a snap of their fingers or with the one push of the button, and your whole popular uprising is down. We never thought about our own independent banking system. Not even our own money, but our own banking system, we don't have that.
Right.
So this is something that you realize only when you're actually dealing with it. Well, I believe that people in there took example from Venezuela when I believe Chavez faced with the same problem, and then he got helped by the workers in the bank and by the students who helped with the passwords from the system and were able to set up the system so that it would continue working. But as you might imagine, this is a huge problem.
Yeah. Because if the funds are totally cut off, and since it is international banking now, like you said, electronic, that complete utter chaos could be caused.
Yeah, not even that the funds are cut off, the whole system is off. Even if you produce something new, you cannot sell it because
right.
you cannot right. send the money unless you start printing coupons for everything.
Right.
Even that takes time and resources.
Well, that's it. We talk sometimes about a moneyless society, but there still has to be something in order, and somebody has to be doing it. Somebody has to be, quote-unquote, leading it. You can't do all these things consensually, okay? You know, it just doesn't...
Well, you can't do them in one day, let's say, like that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, and most important is the news, the information warfare that is going on. In the West, and I'm used to this, and even in West Europe, you know, they pretend that they're even more free than the United States. Well, the media, I mean.
Yeah.
What happens is that there are huge newspapers and television canals and radio stations. And basically, if you have a criticism of existing society, you can't get it on the mainstream media. And, well, as many leftists are, as you said, not only separated from each other, but there is an information vacuum. We can't inform each other. Imagine a huge newspaper which prints and then several million people read it, and it pretends to be free and critical of society in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine if you have your own idea of certain truth that you have seen, but it's not profitable for the government. Well, the media can block you out just like that, and suddenly you become some conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, the average Joe on the street, he is used that his media is the freest because he lived in the West and in other places there's dictatorships, but here in the West there's a free media, isn't it? So everything that the media prints is truly, truly right.
Wrong.
And if you're not in the media, well, then you are not really telling the truth, aren't you?
That's, isn't that amazing?
Just trying to tell you about the average Joe. So this is a very important part of information warfare that we need to learn to master, how to break through that information warfare, and how either through uniting, but still, you know, the capitalists will always have more money. They can always buy you out. So there will be alternatives. There must be some ways. As I said, you need to recognize a problem in order to start solving it.
Yes.
And this is a problem we have.
So the what you're saying is totally true. The media, and here in the U.S., they said that in the 1970s or something, there were 50 or more different corporations and companies that owned all the media, and I mean the major media. I'm not talking about the little small town newspaper. But now there's 6 corporations that own all the media. And they totally tell people what to say. That's why there's a rise in like Democracy Now! Viewers and different things, I mean, which still aren't making mainstream, but, you know, different independent medias. That's why there's so much online now and blog talk and things like that, because a lot of people really do want the truth. They know that they aren't getting it from mainstream media.
Yes, and I guess the majority, what I have noticed recently, especially in Western countries, is depolitization of society. Because when the majority is not really interested in political events, when they're interested in the color of shoes of Britney Spears, or
okay, yeah, boy, yeah, because the people have been dumbed down, they feel powerless, and they watch TV. When see commercials, tell them that if they wear the color of shoes that Britney Spears is wearing, they're going to have all these men panting after them or whatever. It's amazing what people will grab onto, because they want to be happy, and they think this is going to make them happy to spend money on this crap.
Well, everybody wants to be happy. That's
exactly
the purpose of life.
Yeah.
Yet even this whole consumption society in the United States, you know, it's based in such a way that you stay as a slave of the system, because by taking more debts and credits, basically you just work your whole life to pay off
bill
debt
for things that you in many cases don't need. I mean, that's what charge cards have done. I'm not talking about a home or maybe transportation, but all these other things that people have fallen for, and they just go out, they put it on their card. A lot of these people will die owing money.
Yes. And actually, this is what we can see happening on international level, where countries are forced to take on debt from international banks and international monetary institutions.
Yes.
Just like in Ukraine, for example. Ukraine is now the new president is attempting to take as much as possible debt from the West, from United States, from the International Monetary Fund, and from European Union. So imagine, he has to take up all the debt under condition that he must open his borders to import and lock down his local production, so the factories in East Ukraine.
Well, they'll have to practice austerity. That's the first thing that happens when the IMF comes in.
Yes, and then you can imagine that such debt creates only more debt, because
sure.
How are you planning to pay it off if you do not have your own production?
So he's putting the country into slavery.
Well, it's a kind of president which is, if you want to imagine who is at power now, it's kind of person like that, yes. It's what they're turning a highly developed in the past, not only technologically, but culturally, country into a banana republic.
Mm-hmm.
And the danger is that it is at the border of Russia. And I'm not saying that Russia is a socialist state. It's the same oligarchic state. Yet you may imagine that the oligarchs in Russia are nationally oriented. So we might be getting back into imperialistic struggle like it used to be in the First World War, when interests of oligarchs collide. Then you can imagine that regular people are suffering for it, and it gets out of control. So this is the danger about it all, is that actually United States is just getting slightly too close to the Russian borders.
Yes, very much so. They're putting up all these missiles all along in different countries in front of, to the west of Russia. So
yes.
Trying to surround Russia on one side and then, China on the bottom. And, yeah, it's not pretty what the U.S. is trying to do.
The thing is, what I wonder, and this is a very interesting part, is that I see Obama everywhere in a land and in a crisis which doesn't evolve Obama in any slightest part. Like, for example, why don't we see Prime Minister of Australia involving himself in Ukraine?
Yeah.
Or some Latin American leader. Very strange. It looks very strange if you actually are able to ignore the geopolitical tensions. Just like a guy from some weird country from another continent is actively paying and arming another country overseas so that people can fight them each
yeah.
other.
Well, but then when you think about the empire and empire building, it's like, yeah, that's why Obama's there. He and the corporations that own him, it's very sad, really, that we've come to this place. Wow, Alexander, our time is almost up. What would you want to tell our listeners? What should they think about when they think about this horrible civil war, everything that's going on in Ukraine? What should they take away?
Well, the civil struggle resembles a lot the Spanish Civil War in the beginning of 20th century. And actually, it resembles kind of the struggle for independence of the United States. So if they want to personalize themselves with the situation of people of East Ukraine, that's one of the things, and we should find different ways to break through this information blockade. Because just in pure numbers, even if you're a hardcore right-wing member of the United States, basically, United States and Europe will lose money on this war, because you give money to a corrupt individual, mm-hmm. and it will just disappear in a bottomless pit. It's much better to spend it on your own
yeah.
production and development.
Well, but remember now, I mean, war is such a big moneymaker, and more than 50% of the U.S. money goes towards these different war projects. And we have these multinational corporations that are just getting wealthy, either on stealing other countries' resources or on arming people. And they arm both sides, so they're making money.
The question is, when you're dealing with Russia, aren't they trying to bite off more than they can chew? One thing is attacking a small country, which is by itself.
Yeah.
Another thing is dealing with Russians. And not to sound nationalistic, but it's a cultural thing that the United States is very hard to understand. It's a completely different world and different value system.
It is, and I don't believe that the Cold War ever ended. Because I think that the United States has always been leery about Russia, even after the Soviet Union ended. And I think that it's always seen it as a giant that it has to try to control. So I don't know. Alexander, thank you so much.
And thank you, Roseanne.
I hope you'll come back. Please say yes.
Sure. Okay. Thank you very much. For your time.
Thank you. And
bye-bye.
Sleep now, my friend.
All right. Bye.
Nice.